ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिः शृणुयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवांसस्तनूभिः व्यसेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो वरिष्ठनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हो द ऑलमाइटी रियालिटी लेट अस बी केपेबल ऑफ परफॉर्मिंग सैक्रिफाइसेस एंड हियर ऑस्पिशियस साउंड्स विद आवर इयर्स एंड सी ऑस्पिशियस फॉर्म्स विद आवर आईज विद स्ट्रांग एंड स्टेडी लिम्स एंड बॉडी रिमेनिंग प्रेयरफुल लेट अस स्पेंड आवर गॉड गिवन लाइफ directing our minds only to auspicious things. Om peace, peace, peace. Now, in the last verse of this text, the 32nd kariga, 32nd verse, we are discussing the conclusion of Vedanta philosophy. You will remember, if you read it, if you just read the literal translation, you would be struck by the strength of reasoning behind. Na nirodho na cha utpattihi, na baddho na cha sadhakaha, na mumukshur na vai muktaha, ityesha paramarthata. This is the verse. Translation is something like this. There is neither dissolution, death, destruction, and there is no birth or origination. And then there is no such thing as somebody seeking liberation, and there is no bondage. And there is no one who is seeking liberation. And there is no one who has reached or attained liberation. Now, this is in reality the conclusion of Vedanta, the conclusion of Advaita Vedanta. If you do not clearly understand the spiritual and metaphysical significance of this verse, it could even lead to serious misunderstanding, because it could be interpreted as some kind of nihilism, some kind of anarchism. If you say, well, there is no liberation, there is no origination, there is no birth, no death, there is no need to attain spiritual enlightenment, what does it mean? The idea is this, it should be understood. Liberation is not the result of our seeking. Liberation is not the result of attainment. It is not the result of any kind of action. Liberation is an eternal state, a permanent eternal state. Because if liberation were the result of work, if it was something that we attain, then that state cannot be eternal. If you say somebody gets liberated, somebody gets the supreme spiritual knowledge, it means from a state of absence of knowledge, that person is reaching a state of attaining the knowledge. So there was a time, there was a state when the knowledge did not exist, which would mean that knowledge comes into existence. And anything which comes into existence had a state where it did not exist and will have a state when it will not exist. Therefore, we are already liberated even before we become liberated. But then what really happens? We are just removing the wrong notion that we are bound. Liberation means removal of the wrong notion that we are in bondage. Bondage is the wrong notion that we are bound. Bondage is not bondage. Bondage is the only the illusion, the wrong notion that we are in bondage. It is not bondage. It is only the wrong notion that we are in bondage. Similarly, spiritual liberation, the ultimate realization that we are consciousness, we are not this psychophysical mechanisms, we are something beyond all this. This is the real state. So when we talk about liberation, we are just removing the wrong notion that we normally have. What is the wrong notion? The wrong notion that we are in bondage, or the wrong notion that we are not in a state of liberation. Because anything which remains permanent should have existed at all times, and therefore it cannot come into existence, because coming into existence means a transition from a point of non-existence to a point of existence. And destruction or dissolution means the transition from a point of existence to a point where you won't exist. Means from existence you go to non-existence. That is called destruction or dissolution. That's a point to be remembered. Now, if you keep that in mind, we know very well that there is no bondage. If there is no bondage, there can be no one who is bound. And if there is no bondage, there is no effort for liberation. Then what is the effort? Why are we reading all these books? Why are we discussing Vedanta? Why do we pray? Why do we meditate? Why do we discuss all these things? All these things are required to remove the wrong notion that we are in bondage. Just as we bring light not to produce the rope, but to remove darkness, which was responsible for the illusion of snake. You have to remember that analogy again. A room which is not properly lit, there is an object lying in front of you. It looks like a rope. It is a rope, but it looks like a snake. So you bring light. The light doesn't produce rope. The light's role is confined to removing the darkness, which was responsible for creating the illusion that it was a snake. So that point. Similarly, instructions, teachings and meditations, etc., spiritual practices, etc., will not produce liberation, but will produce ignorance. Will remove ignorance. Meditation, scriptural reading, discussion, all spiritual practices remove ignorance. Just like the light that you bring to the room removes darkness. And once darkness is removed, then you don't need anybody to proclaim, to make a proclamation that it is a rope, because it is self-revealed. But there is one difference. In the rope snake analogy, we are dealing with objects external objects. But in Vedanta, we are dealing with our own being. When we think we are this body, when we think we are this mind, when we think we are this intellect, all these problems arise. But the moment these wrong notions are removed, then what we are is self-revealed. Swami Vivekananda used one important term to refer to this phenomenon in his inspired talks in Thousand Island Park and elsewhere also. He used to dehypnotization. You know. We are in a state of hypnotism. So we are this body. So people fight for small things and spend their whole lifetime pulling out their hair, whole lifetime, spending whole time. Just imagine, can you imagine people fighting for small petty things if they at least intellectually understand we are the Supreme Consciousness? If intellectually, if they remind themselves every day, if you read a few verses, that itself is a great thing. That is like trying to bring light to the room. Intellectual, that's why in Vedanta, discussion is very important. See, Vedanta tells you, as a Shankaracharya's dictum is, Srutya, Yuktya, Swanubhutya. First, you have to read the scripture. You have to use your own reasoning, your own intelligence to think and understand. And then you have to bring it to your own experience. Well, experience is the last criterion. Anubhava avasanatva. Shankaracharya says in different bhashyas, Brahma Sutra bhashya, Brihadaranyaka, he says, Anubhava avasanatva. The meaning is this, one's own intuitive inner experience is the last criterion in spiritual wisdom, spiritual enlightenment. That's meaning, one's own intuitive experience. But before you reach experience, we have to remove all the weeds, dirt, and filth which have already we have accumulated in our mind. We are this body, that's why I need that means of fighting over every small things at the mental level, intellectual level, physical level. So constant reading and understanding and discussing these things will remove these weeds and undesirable growth at least bit by bit and will make the mind ready for experience. That is the point. Therefore, a question is always raised in Vedanta. If scriptures cannot reveal Atman, scriptures cannot fully interpret, define, and describe or explain the absolute reality, what is the role of scriptures? The scriptures play the role of the light that you bring. And discussion, reading, contemplation, prayer, meditation, they are like our efforts involved in going out, bringing a light. Because when you bring the light, you understand it is, after all, a rope, not a snake. All these efforts are necessary. Therefore, this Vedanta says that the reading of scriptures is necessary, prayer is necessary, spiritual practices are necessary to remind ourselves that we are the Supreme Consciousness. That's the important point. Second point to remember is that analogy should be contemplated a little deeper. If you have to just think of the analogy. I have repeated this many times, so I shall refer to it. Now, you have to think of the room which is not properly lit, there is not enough light, a piece of something is lying in front of you. It is in reality a piece of rope, but you mistake it to be a snake, which it is not. And then you bring light, and then you realize that it is not snake, it is a rope. So now we have to start thinking. What do you do when bring light? The snake is removed. Rather, the snake idea is removed. But for a person who thought it is a real cobra and who had gone out to bring a stick and maybe in the process, if he had fallen and broken his neck, for that person, it is a real snake till the light is brought and till the illusion is removed. During the 10 minutes involved in running in search of a stick, and perhaps in some cases it can involve some difficulties also, and these unpleasant experiences like you may fall over, you may break your neck. And for such a person, when he is struggling hard to get a good stick to beat and kill a so-called snake, he is actually thinking it is a snake, maybe a cobra. So when he comes here, and suddenly somebody brings light and he realizes it is a piece of rope. Now, where the snake idea did exist in him. And now he understands it's a rope. Now, what he mistook to be the snake is now recognized to be the rope. Without the rope, there could be no snake idea. Because the rope was there, the shape of the rope, maybe the color too, must have reminded him of a snake that he had seen in the zoo the previous day. So all these thought processes came together to form the snake illusion. Now, the snakeness is negated in the rope. The same object, which actually was the rope, was mistaken to be the snake. Without the existence of the rope, there could be no snake idea. Similarly, when we think we are this body, we are this mind, these are all superimpositions, like the snake and then the crack on the floor. There are four other superimpositions which I referred to, the snake, the stick, the thin stream of light, and a crack on the floor, the four superimpositions. Now, we think we are this body, we are this mind, we are this intellect, etc. All these are superimpositions on the Atman, on the consciousness. When these superimpositions are removed, then what remains? Consciousness. So, to remove these superimpositions, we need these discussions, these contemplations on Vedantic idea. So the snakeness is removed on the rope. Similarly, when mindness is removed, then consciousness alone remains. When we think we are this body, we need many things related to this body. When we think we are the intellect, then we have many desires and superimpositions related to intellect. And so also with regard to mind. When all these are removed, what remains is consciousness. So, in fact, to remove all these superimpositions, we need an effort. That effort is actually the significance of trying to be liberated. Liberation is not a result of an act, but an effort to get liberated helps us to remove the superimposition. And once the superimposition is removed, the reality of consciousness is revealed. So it is self-revealed. That point is very significant in the context of this 32nd verse. Otherwise, this 32nd verse sometimes could be interpreted in terms of Nagarjuna's doctrine of emptiness, Shunyavada. So in the grand celebrated commentaries of Shankaracharya and others, there are different efforts made to rule out the possibility of this being interpreted in terms of either Shunyavada or the doctrine of emptiness, and also the subjective idealism of the later Buddhists like Asanga, Dignaga and others. Of course, I am not going to deal with them at this stage. We'll come to that next verse now. Now we will come to the 33rd verse. The 33rd verse is this: Bhavaihi asadbhirevayam advayena cha kalpitah bhava apya advayena iva tasmat advayata shiva. This verse is in fact a confirmation of certain ideas. The idea is this: this Atman, this consciousness, is imagined both as unreal objects, which are actually non-existent, and also many other mental and also physical objects. And the purpose of our contemplation, our discussion, is to remove all these wrong ideas or superimpositions. I explained these ideas already, so we will go to the next verse. But the most important verse here in this context is coming later. I will come to that again. You find here one verse, that is 37th verse, is very important from the Advaita point of view, philosophical point of view. We'll come to that. Before that, there are a few more ideas are to be explained. 34th verse. Na atma bhavena nanedam na svenapi kathanjana na prithak na prithak kinjit iti tattu vidho viduhu. Now, this world of multiplicity, this world which is seen to be many things, this world of plurality or diversity or multiplicity, which I actually imagined, cannot be said to be Atman. Now remember, in Vedanta, one point is this. As you spiritually evolve and metaphysically as you go further, you evolve and you graduate from the many to one, from multiplicity and plurality and diversity towards unity and oneness. So wherever you see many or the plurality or multiplicity, that is because of ignorance. So the first point is this multiplicity, which is actually a product of pure imagination. It cannot be said to be identical with Atman, because Atman is one reality. So that means all the different superimpositions are superimpositions on the same reality. The same rope is mistaken to be a snake by one person, because he has seen a snake similar in shape and size to that rope somewhere. Or by another person, that rope may be mistaken to be a stick, a curved stick, or maybe a crack on the floor, and so on, depending upon the imagination, the accumulated thought currents of the individual who is seeing this. Now, so it's very clear that this rope is different from snake, etc. But is the rope really different from the snake? It is different, it is non-different. Both are right. Without there being a rope, you can never mistake the rope to be the snake. So is the snake different from the rope? No. But is the snake the same as the rope? No, because it is not snake. So that point to be understood. So when we talk about I am the mind, we are right and also we are wrong. We are not the mind that is fluctuating. That is true. But what we mistake to be the mind is in reality consciousness. Because in reality we are consciousness. That's the point. So, it is very, very subtle idea. So, again you have to go back to the old rope. The rope is separate and also non-separate from the snake. The rope cannot be separate, because if there was no rope, you won't think there is a snake where nothing exists. A piece of rope is lying there. Because of the shape and size, a person mistakes that rope to be the snake. So in a way, the rope is the snake, and what is mistaken to be the snake is the rope. So they are non-separate. But then, are they the same? Because it is not a snake, it is rope only. So it is not the same. It is separate and also non-separate. Prithak, separate. Aprithak means non-separate. Two terms are used in the Sanskrit verse. So, when you look around, when you see this multiplicity, these diverse objects, everything in this world, all these things are as name and form, they are different from Atman. And name and form are only illusionary. name and form are the products of pure imagination. The same clay, when you make that, when they turn the clay into a cup, you call it a cup because of the shape. Pot, it's a pot. If you make a big vessel, then you give it another name. So depending upon the shape, you give, that means the form, you give it name also. But then it's only clay only. It's only clay. Gold, you make different ornaments with the gold. And depending upon the shape, you give it name. If you look at the gold from the angle of snake, sorry, the angle of name and form, well, there are 1,000 different ornaments made of the same type of gold. There are 1,000 different objects, different ornaments. But as gold, they are the same. As ornaments, they are different. But that difference is only the difference in name and form. And name and form are only our imaginations. Therefore, they cannot be real. That's why it is stated here. So even when we ourselves, when we imagine ourselves to be the mind, we are in fact calling consciousness by the wrong name. We call it mind, that's all. The consciousness is self-effulgent, self-revealing, immanent and omnipresent. But that is interpreted as something much smaller, much given to change. So we call it mind. So what we wrongly call mind is in fact the consciousness. So that is the point to be remembered here. So multiplicity, which is the product of human imagination, as multiplicity, as plurality, a diversity cannot be the same as consciousness. But if you remove that diversity aspect from it, then it is consciousness itself. That's the point here. So prithak, apruthak, these two terms are used here. Prithak actually means different, apruthak means non-different. So even when we consider ourselves to be this body, we don't become this body, we are the Atman only, we are calling it by the wrong name, that's all. If you consider yourself to be this body, then, well, body has to follow its rules and regulations, subject to change and destruction. Then if you think you are only this body, then you think you are yourself something perishable, something which comes and goes. But if you consider yourself to be the Atman, then you can look upon your body as something which comes and goes, that you are yourself something beyond and above all this. That is the only difference here. This is the essence of the 34th verse. Now we'll come to 35th verse. Now, the 35th verse is actually a reply, a response to people who interpret these verses as atheistic. Now, there is a one point to be remembered. The author of this book, Gaudapada. Gaudapada lived in an age when Shunyavada of Nagarjuna was very prominent. And also, Vedanta was sometimes interpreted in atheistic terms, in nihilistic terms, by many philosophers belonging to one particular school of thought, which were called the Charvaka school of philosophy, the ancient Indian materialism, who had already become prominent in India around 8th or 9th century BC. That means 200, 300 years before the birth of Buddha and also Vardhamana Mahavira, the founder of Jaina religion. These atheist schools had become very prominent. They had a large following among the intellectual circles. So they used to interpret many of these verses in atheistic or nihilistic terms. See, if you tell somebody the reality cannot be explained, it cannot be defined, it cannot be objectified, then it is not a long distance from that stage to the next stage of interpreting the same reality as something non-existent. It's possible. People may interpret that reality as something non-existent. So there is only thin line of demarcation between the highest Advaita Vedanta Advaita philosophy and also nihilism, according to some schools of thinkers who were prominent during the Gaudapada's time, around 6th or 7th century AD we are talking about. So Gaudapada wants to defend Advaita Vedanta against a possible misinterpretation of this philosophy by the materialists in their own terms. So he gives a reply in this 35th verse. So he says, Vitarag bhayakrothehi munibhir vedaparagehi nirvigalpo khyayam drishtaha prapanchopashamo advayaha. This is the verse. The verse is a complicated verse. If you want, I can give the prose order. Vitarag bhayakrothehi vedaparagehi munibhihi nirvigalpaha prapanchopashamaha ayam advayaha drishtaha hi. This is the meaning. The simple meaning is this. In ancient times, great sages and men and women of spiritual wisdom who have reached the highest level of spiritual enlightenment and who are completely free from all attachments, all fear and all anger, all types of mental aberrations, and who have gone deep into the meaning of the Vedantic scriptures, realized this Atman. Such great sages have realized this Atman as the supreme reality, which is free from all types of attributes. And once this reality is realized, the moment one gets an intuitive experience of the immanent reality within, then this multiplicity, this plurality, this diversity completely vanishes. This is the literal translation of this verse. So Gaudapada asserts that there is a way, there is a path for one to attain this reality, to reach this level of spiritual experience, inner experience. One should be completely free from all types of attachments, obsessions, then too much of attachment towards somebody or something, and too much of aversion from somebody or something, and again anger, feeling that this is mine, it's not mine, and so on, all these attachments and aversions. The moment you are free from all these obstacles in spiritual life, you can realize the supreme truth, because the sages in ancient times did realize this supreme truth, did experience this supreme truth. This is the statement, this is the literal translation. So just a reply. I mean, indirectly, Gaudapada asserts that this is something which one can really experience. Perhaps this is the one point where Advaitic concept of absolute reality differs from the Kantian concept. Where Kant said it is something unknown and unknowable, Advaita said it is unknown to the five senses, mind and intellect. It is unknowable to the intellect and senses, but it could be known through experience, not through objectification of knowledge, but through one's own intuitive experience. The sage, the spiritual seeker, he investigates into this truth, and ultimately he realizes that truth is the immanent reality within himself. That is the point. So it is unknown to the senses and mind and intellect and scriptures and books and definitions. But it is known through intuitive experience, not through objectified knowledge, but through intuitive experience. This is the idea behind. That you find in the ancient Vedic, in the Rigvedic hymn, there is a famous hymn which actually is philosophically very grand. It begins Nasadasi, Nosadasi, Tadani. In the beginning, there was neither existence nor non existence. That is how it begins. And at one point, the Rigveda Samhita tells you that in ancient times, the great sages went in search of the absolute reality. They investigated into the true nature of the point of origination of the universe, of the reality behind this universe. And they searched everywhere in the external world, but they did not succeed. And then they turned their inquiry inward. And once they turned their inquiry inward, they realized that what they were seeking outside was in fact within themselves, as the immanent reality within themselves. And the same reality is the omnipresent reality, the all-pervading reality everywhere. So, Satobandhum Asadi Niravindan Hridi Pradeshya Kavayo Manisha. Satobandhum means the ultimate cause of this creation. That's what. They were searching for the ultimate cause of this creation, the mystery behind creation, the absolute reality behind this creation. And then they went and searched in the external world, but they failed to discover it in the external world. And when they turned their inquiry towards themselves, when the inquiry was turned inward, then they realized that the reality they were seeking was within themselves, and the same reality is the immanent reality, all-pervading reality. It is also the immanent residing principle present in all beings. That idea is brought out here. And now Gaudapada gives an advice, the author gives an advice here. Tasmadevam vidityainam advaide yojayet smritim advaidam samanuprapya jadavat lokamacharyet. So a number of ideas are given here. Now one should try to realize the Atman. One should try to understand, at least from scriptures, by reading, at least intellectually, should realize that we are something beyond this body and mind and intellect. We are the Supreme Consciousness, the Atman. And then one should try to fix one's mind on that thought. And then, having fixed our mind on that ideal, live in this world, do our duty to the best of our ability. Of course, one should not be negligent or indifferent towards duties and responsibilities, but keep somewhere at least in some distant corner of our mind, keep this idea, well, all these that I'm doing are my duties, but they are all subject to change. They are not eternal. It is the feeling that what we are going to attain is eternal that disturbs the mind. This is a very important point. You know, why do we get obsessed with wealth and money? We know any student of psychology will tell you that money and whatever we look for in this external world cannot bring everlasting happiness. That we know. But the moment we get involved in some actions, we forget that. intellectually we may know this, but the moment we are after something, we have a feeling that it will solve all the problems. Unless that obsessive mentality is there, one will not give out of his way. One will go out of his way in his efforts to attain material objects. So, intellectually we may know, but the moment we undertake a task, a competition, cutthroat competition, and then we go out of the way. People take resort to most questionable means for attaining their goals. For a split second, they believe that this is everlasting. What I'm going to gain by this effort is everlasting. That thought suddenly catches our mind. And that makes us play foul games in life. On the other hand, if we can keep in mind that we have to do our work, we have to perform our duties and responsibilities, but the world can never bring us eternal peace and happiness. Keeping that in mind, if we can work, then we won't play foul games. And not only that, along with that, we had to also keep in mind that we are something beyond this body. We are not the mind that is going to enjoy the fleeting comforts, the body which is enjoying the external objects. There is something beyond all this, which I am, the Supreme Consciousness. So that should be kept in mind. And then live in this world. That is the instruction which Gaudiya Bhada gives. Literally, of course, the language used is different, you know. He says, one should behave in this world as if he is dull-witted. So, jadavat achari. Jadava means dull-wit. That's not what actually what he means. Keep in this world, said he, so, you know, in St. Paul's, you know, be wise in Christ and be fool in world. Be fool in world and be wise in Christ. He means something like this. No. So, spiritually, if you become wise, then you can afford to be somewhat foolish in this world, you know. But if you become wise in this world, and then ultimately we realize this worldly wisdom ultimately ends in worldly foolishness in the end, where everything collapses. That we don't realize it at that moment, that's all. So worldly wisdom is actually nothing but worldly foolishness. But the point is, we don't realize it till the last moment, till it is very late. That's the main difference. Now we are coming to a very famous verse. This is also one of the conclusive statements of Advaita. Gaudiya Bhada says, Nistudir nirnamaskaro nisudhakara evacha chalachala nikiyatascha idir yadrichigo bhavet. This also, it contains a great metaphysical truth and also a great instruction on how one should practice non-dualistic philosophy in actual life. So the literal translation is somewhat, incomplete, but when we explain it, we'll understand it. Avoiding all praise, nistutihi. Stuti means praising somebody. Doesn't mean that. People generally praise others only to get something. So a really wise person will neither blame nor praise anyone. Because anybody who praises and blames has some his own axe to grind, something to achieve. So the real picture of a person of supreme wisdom, he neither goes out of his way to praise, to play someone, nor does he displease anyone deliberately. That's the idea behind. So, nistutihi, nirnamaskaro. So, these are the state of a spiritual person of the highest wisdom, spiritual achievement is portrayed here. The great spiritual giants who have experienced the presence of the Supreme Divinity everywhere, for whom this world is a play, for whom whatever is attainable in this world is a matter of a moment and won't last for long. They will never make any effort to attain anything in this world. That the picture of the highest spiritual enlightenment, a man of or a woman of the highest spiritual enlightenment, is graphically portrayed here. Such a spiritual person, he will avoid all praise. Means he won't go out of his way to please someone or praise someone. Nirnamaskara, namaskara means formal salutation. Doesn't mean that he'll be rude or anything. He'll be living this world in a state of supreme consciousness. Nisvathakara. Svathakara, that is a little explanation required for those who are interested. Svatha is a mantra used by people when they perform certain rituals to departed souls, in memory of departed souls. Svatha is the word. There are certain terms used in Sanskrit. Swaha, Svatha, Vashat, all these are used in different contexts. Some of them are used in formal worship. Some of them are used in Vedic sacrifices. And some of them are used only in certain rituals performed in memory of departed souls. Svatha is one such. The point is, a person of the highest spiritual experience won't feel any need to do anything, either to remember anyone or to praise anyone or to please anyone. Because he constantly, every moment, he experiences his non-separatedness, his non-distinction, his unity with the entire creation. He feels and experiences his unity with the entire creation. The complete unity of existence is a matter of experience to him. So he won't feel any need for pleasing anyone or formally going out of his way to greet anyone, anything like that. That characteristic, that highest state of spiritual wisdom, equanimity, is mentioned here. And he will be above all these rituals. He may not take the trouble to perform any of these elaborate rituals. Because rituals are normally performed by people, ordinary people, for some benefits. But a spiritually enlightened, liberated person won't feel any need even to pray to God. Because it's not that he won't feel any need to pray to God, because he feels the Supreme Divinity is within himself. Should not mistake that he will consider himself to be God and everyone should pray to him. No, it's not that way. He feels the immanent reality present everywhere. He transcends all rituals, all conventions, all practices. That's why, you know, as I said earlier on many occasions, there are two levels of spiritual practice. At the beginning, we may believe that the primitive level, most primitive level, we believe that if we read a book or if we pray in a place of worship, God will be happy. He will be very pleased. Which means if we don't do that, he will be terribly displeased. By which we are limiting God to our own level. Because when your friend says something very pleasant to you, you are happy. If he scolds you, he quarrels with you, you are unhappy. So we are actually putting God in our own place. So he thinks God would be happy if I prayed to him and will be unhappy if I don't pray to him. Now, such people generally confine their spiritual life to a few hours of everyday life. Reading books in a ceremonial way, performing certain rituals as a ceremony. For them, spirituality is confined to certain external rituals and performances. This is not contempt. This is not condemned in any of the scriptures. But we have to remember, this is only the beginning of spiritual life. This is not the supreme goal. And as he evolves further and further, his concept of God also evolves. Slowly, as he spiritually evolves, in proportion to the evolution of his own spirituality, his concept of God also evolves. As he becomes more broad-minded, and when he reaches the highest spiritual level, he thinks of God as an all-pervading reality, present everywhere, in everything. And he also feels the need to practice godliness within. See, one sign of a godly person is a little bit of some of the attributes of the God whom he believes in can be found in his own character. If you are praying to a compassionate God whole 24 hours of the day, and you are yourself a terribly cruel person, then there is a complete dichotomy between the God whom you are praying to and your own entity. So as we practice the ideal of a particular divine principle, slowly we also start imbibing some of those attributes in our own character. So a person who believes in God, who is compassionate, cannot be a cruel person. He also will have a little bit of that compassion which he finds praiseworthy in his God. So as a person reaches the highest level of spiritual evolution, he thinks of God as a supreme, all-pervading, omnipresent, immanent principle, the transcendental principle, who is a divine principle, residing everywhere, existing everywhere. And he starts experiencing the presence of that divinity within himself. And he also experiences the presence of the entire universe in that God. So he experiences the presence of God in all beings and the presence of all beings in God. In fact, in the devotional classic, it's known as Bhagavata. There's a verse, Sarva Bhudeshuya Pashyet Bhagavad Bhavam Atmanaha Bhudani Bhagavadi Atmani Esha Bhagavadottamaha. The verse says, the best devotee of God is he who feels the presence of God in all beings and the presence of all beings in God also. So, the greatest Advaitin also is the greatest devotee. Because at the experience level, the purest, the most sublime devotion, and the highest spiritual wisdom, Advaita or non-dualistic philosophy, in his experience level, are the same, no difference. So here, we can get a picture of such a sublime spiritual personality. So, he sees and he experiences the presence of the divine everywhere, including himself, and the presence of the entire universe and creation in the divine. Nistudi nirnamaskara nisodhakara evacha chalachara niketascha idri yadrichigo bhavi yetihi, one who has completely controlled his mind, intellect and senses, which means a person of highest spiritual experience. So he should be self-controlled. and is an ascetic. Sometimes he may think of this body, this changing body, as a support. Sometimes he may think of Atman as his support. But he never is obsessed with anything. He is happy and satisfied with whatever comes to him by chance. This is the state of the highest spiritual experience, as I explained here. Now we will conclude. We have got about 5 minutes. If with the next verse we will conclude this chapter, we will deal with the next class. Om, peace, peace, peace.